Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Thursday, April 4th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to have a conversation about the new Netflix series, Ripley. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor and chief film critic, Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
All right, Chris. I thought it might be good for us to sort of format this conversation in like a non-spoiler section in the beginning, and then we'll get into spoilers a little bit later on, just to give people a bit of an idea of like our general thoughts on this and whether or not we think it's worth watching. Before we get into this actual new Netflix show, though, I wanted to ask you about your relationship to the movie, The Talented Mr. Ripley, and also Patricia Highsmith's novels, which are the subject matter for the source material for these adaptations. So have you read those books, and what's your relationship like with The Talented Mr. Ripley movie?
You know, I haven't read the books. This show actually made me want to finally get around to reading them, so I probably will at some point. But I have seen The Talented Mr. Ripley, which when it first came out, I did not like it because I think I was just too young and stupid to appreciate it. But since then, I've revisited it, and I think it's fantastic. It's got an incredible cast. I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman is in it, and he's always good, but he's so good in this. And Matt Damon is really good in it playing, I guess you could say he's playing against type because he doesn't really play characters like that often. Mm-hmm. And it just got that great like 60s Italian countryside vibe to it. I don't know. It's a really good, creepy, unsettling movie. And I dig the movie a lot.
I have not read the novels either, and similarly, this show definitely made me want to. I wonder if it was just like spending more time in this world and sort of maybe being opened up to the possibilities of what the novel might contain. And then The Talented Mr. Ripley is one of those movies that I feel like I should know better than I do. Like, I think I've seen it only twice, and I really liked it both times, but like, I could not remember when I was watching this Ripley show, I remembered several incidents in the story, but I couldn't remember how it ended. And I was like, man, I should know The Talented Mr. Ripley better than I do. I should remember how that film ended. But it made for an interesting viewing experience for me. So I guess I would say that I'm like a loose fan of the movie because I liked it, but I just don't know it very well. And I would recommend, I didn't rewatch it before watching this series. I don't know if you did. But I would recommend, I mean, for people who maybe saw the movie years ago, it's not like, I don't think you have to rewatch the movie. I liked the show quite a bit without having that film fresh on my mind. So what would your take be there?
Yeah, you know, it's different because they're very different. Like, again, I haven't read the book, so I don't know which adaptation, you know, based on I read the Wikipedia page for the book, and based on that, it sounds like the show is probably more faithful to the book than the movie, but there, we'll get into this, I guess, when we talk more about in like spoiler territory, but they're very, to me at least, they feel like very different sort of takes on this character and this material. Like they're played in very different ways. So I'm not sure if you need to revisit it or not, but I think it is an interesting experiment to like sort of watch them back to back and see how the film interprets the book, you know, in ways the show doesn't and vice versa.
Oh man, that's fascinating. Okay, yeah, we'll definitely talk about that a little bit more in spoilers. So give me your spoiler-free thoughts about the show.
I really dug it. I do think it sort of fizzles out in the end. Like it sort of like loses its momentum as it goes along. But from a visual standpoint, this is like one of the best looking shows like Netflix has ever done. Originally, it was set up, I was reading on this, it was really set up to be a Showtime series, and I wonder if that has anything to do with it, but it definitely does not look like your typical Netflix show where everything is sort of like bland and shot in this sort of flat way. It's very noir-esque and stylish, and you know, not even, and I don't just mean because it's in black and white, just the way it's shot. It's shot in this very, almost like, what's the word? Surrealist sort of way. It's like almost like, where like German expressionism sort of,
yeah,
it's got that sort of like vibe to it. And it's just a lot of shadows and the way things are shot, and it's shot in this really unique, fascinating, almost like haunting way. So from a visual standpoint, I really dug it. From a story standpoint, I liked it. I think I liked the movie a bit more. Again, I haven't read the book, so I can't comment on like which did the adaptation better, but I kind of like the way the movie handled things more. And like, it's kind of hard for me to separate them because they're telling the same story and they're telling the same story in different ways. But I really dug the show a lot. Andrew Scott, great actor in general, and I really like his take on Ripley here. Again, we'll get into more on that on when we get into spoiler territory. I just want to get to the spoilers. Let's get to the spoilers, Ben. Damn it.
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a second. I fully agree. I thought that like maybe the last couple episodes were like maybe just a little bit slower or something as the story kind of comes to an end. But because those first few episodes just feel so like you're drawn into this world. And I think the visuals are a huge part of that. Like they're so sumptuous and it really just like paints this wonderful picture of like a very specific place. And you can tell that they actually went and filmed this thing on location and it's not, you know, shot in the volume or whatever. And it just like feels so refreshing in that way. Podcast episode, maybe longtime listeners will remember, or not even really that long time because this just happened, but I spoke with the director of Bob Marley One Love, and he worked with Robert Elswit, the cinematographer, and he was telling me about the way that Elswit decides to go to locations like multiple times to really, really scout things, not just like go once or twice and kind of figure out what you're going to do. He like really pays close attention to the locations and thinks very clearly about the camera angles, and Robert Elswit shot this show as well. And you can tell that there are so many like interesting shots. Like it's just a really visually interesting show. It is not shot like every other thing. It feels like it has a real perspective. And there are so many shots that are like, it just feels like they found like the coolest angle to possible in that location to film from, you know? So, yeah, that was just a really cool aspect of the show. The black and white, I thought worked really, really well, even in a sort of far flung, like exotic location, like Italy, you know, it has that, it's still like really beautiful cinematography. At the very beginning, I was like, oh man, there's going to be a whole show about Italy and we're not going to be able to see the colors of it. Like that's kind of like the look of it is what I think of when I think about the movie, because it's just so distinct and those colors are like, so they pop so well, that I was a little worried about the black and white, but I actually think it works really well here because it's just a different kind of beauty, you know, like it's still gorgeous to look at. It's just, it's different. And I spoke with Steven Zalian. People will hear that interview at the end of our conversation here. But I asked him a little bit about that black and white. So he talks about that just a bit. But what did you think about Andrew Scott? You mentioned him and how you liked that performance. What did you think about him here?
It's a really very nuanced performance. It's a very internal performance. He's sort of playing around with the character's almost like a lack of humanity sort of in a way. And again, we'll get into that when we talk about the spoilers, we'll talk about how it compares to the movie and stuff like that. But it's a very cold sort of performance, which I found like a really interesting take on this character, because all my reference to the character is the movie. And I found that I guess this isn't even a spoiler, but the movie version he seems like really pathetic, and he's also driven by like sexual sort of urges. Like the movie is very homoerotic in a deliberate sort of way that I found the show is not at all. The show almost like downplays the sexuality, I felt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and me too.
There's even like I can't remember the exact line, but there's a part where they're the characters are talking about Tom Ripley, and they basically say like he's too weird to have any sort of sexuality to him, sort of.
Yeah,
that's sort of like the way Andrew Scott plays the character, in that he's not like attracted to the Dickie Greenleaf character. He just wants to be him. He doesn't actually find him like sexually attractive. And I found that like a very interesting way to play that character, that he plays him like he's playing him as like almost like an alien, sort of like from another planet, like just inhabiting. Like a pod person, if you will.
Yeah.
It's like inhabiting this human form. And that's why he's so good at being a con artist, because he doesn't really have like a sort of unique humanity to him. So I found that like a really fascinating way to play that character.
Yeah, I was thinking kind of like a vampire, you know, where he just like wants to consume this guy's essence. But I think you're right. I think an alien is a better metaphor there, because he really does, like, especially in that scene where he dresses up, and this is not really a spoiler, but he wears Dickie Greenleaf's clothes at one point. And that is, just the way that he kind of talks, you know, where he like talks to himself almost as different characters. It's like he's putting on these personas and wearing them like costumes or something in a way. So,
yeah,
really fascinating stuff there. Okay, let's just go ahead and get into spoilers now. So this is the final warning for people who have not watched all of the show. It's on Netflix right now, the entire season. I think it's 8 episodes total. Sounds like Chris and I both agree that it's definitely worth your time, worth watching, even if like the ending maybe slows down a little bit. So, okay, spoiler heavy section here. I was hoping that you could sort of walk me through some of the differences between the movie and the show, because like I said, I don't really remember the movie super well. So what were the biggest things that jumped out to you?
Yeah, so for the most, like the first few episodes is almost identical story-wise. But again, like I said, like the Tom Ripley in the movie feels a lot more sexually driven than the Tom Ripley in the show. And again, I don't know how that compares to the book. I mean, the book was written in like the 50s, so I doubt it's like overtly sexual to begin with. But but the character in the movie is a lot more pathetic. He's a lot more of a Weasley sort of loser, I feel like. And I didn't get that from Andrew Scott's performance. Like, even though he's pathetic in his own sort of ways, he's not pathetic in that sort of way that Matt Damon plays the character, where he's like, he almost like stumbles into becoming the con artist that he is. And so that's really the sexuality is like the biggest difference to me on both based on the show and the movie. I don't know, like you said, you don't really remember the movie that well, but I don't know if you picked up on that too.
Yeah, I think it's just the way that Scott plays the character. It's almost like he's not a great con man. He's not a great criminal. He's not great at this thing that he wants to do, which is basically like subsume everything about Dickie Greenleaf and like absorb his life into his own and take on his own thing. He kind of like bumbles and stumbles his way through things. Like he gets backed into corners and makes like what he conceives to be the only decision that he can, seemingly without really thinking about the consequences too far in advance. And then is kind of like confronted with like, oh shit, I've done this. Now I've got to figure out a way to, you know, figure, you know, either like pave over this lie or create a new series of lies to pave over the ones that I just told, or like bury a body or whatever the case may be. And just watching Scott sort of watching the wheels work behind his eyes as he tries to figure that stuff out is really fascinating. And the show itself is super methodical. Like it does not just jump away. And I talk about this with Steven Zaillian a little bit too. So I apologize for repeating myself, but it does not really jump away and like, kind of hand wave away developments in the plot. It really like stays with you and stays with these characters rather, and like forces you to watch them go through every single, component of making a decision and like all of the consequences that play out from that. So yeah, it's really interesting in that way.
It's a show that shows how hard it is to get rid of a dead body. It's not, I thought it was like my favorite part. There's like two separate instances where Tom Ripley kills someone and then has to like get rid of the body or get rid of like the evidence. And both instances unfold in these really long, they're not even montages. They're long sequences where he's like doing all this work to like cover up the blood or sink a boat or move a body. And it's like, I could never do this because man, it's exhausting. I mean, not even on like on a moral level. I'm just like, oh my God, just like, Jesus Christ, it's so much work to get rid of a body. I would give up halfway through. I'd be like, I would like throw the body out a window and be like, all right, I'm done with this. I hope no one finds that body.
The cops would just look up and point to you. And they'd be like, there's the man that did it right there.
He did a terrible job covering this up.
The scene where he's like putting all those rocks in the boat, it just like seemed like it took so long for him to do that. So
yeah, it's very, like you said, it's very methodical. And it's I found that fascinating, the way it doesn't like, I guess that's sort of like what you can do with a TV show too. You can take your time and show, like the movie does the methodical things too, but the show does it like, it takes it to like the nth degree where it's like, oh my God, this is a lot of work and he's going through all this work. And back to the differences too. I haven't seen the movie in a while, but I don't remember the police investigation being like a really big part of the movie. It's almost like it's like very briefly touched on in the movie, as far as I remember. And the show, it introduces a whole new character in the last, like the back, like three or four episodes.
Yeah.
And it's like the detective and he's investigating and he almost becomes like the main character. And I actually feel like those are like the weakest episodes of the show, because I'm more interested in Tom than I am in, even though that actor, I don't know his name in front of me. I think the actor does a really good job and he has a really cool way of delivering lines and stuff like that. But I found that character like I don't really care about this detective guy that much.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. I actually really liked him because I was so like ready for Tom Ripley to meet some sort of comeuppance. So I was like immediately on this detective's side, you know, in terms of like, well, it's interesting though, because the show really made, and I think the movie probably does this as well, but I don't really remember it super well. But the show does this interesting thing where like you're watching Tom Ripley kind of from afar and he does something despicable and you're like, oh man, this guy is like a real son of a bitch. And then it sticks with him so much that you're kind of like, you know, he almost gets caught or something. And like, you're kind of like, my experience as a viewer anyway, was like, I almost like didn't want him to get caught in those moments, but I do overall. But like in these micro moments along the way, I'm like, oh God, like he's almost going to get caught. But like, you know, do this, you know, evade this way, make this decision to get away with it. And then like, you know, the show will sort of back up a little bit and I'll back up a little bit as a viewer and be like, no, wait a second. I actually hate this guy. And like, I want him to lose. So I'm on this detective side. So it's this really cool balance back and forth. They do a good job with that, I think.
I think part of it is because of those long drawn out scenes. Like we spend so much time watching him do all this work to cover up his crimes that we become invested in it. And it's fascinating because like in those final episodes where, it's Dakota Fanning's character Marge comes to stay with him and it almost looks like she's gonna like figure out, and you like, I don't know about you, but I was just like, oh, I hate Marge right now. I hate that she's like so close to like figuring out what's up, and then it turns out she doesn't figure it out at all, and you're like, ah, take that, Marge, you're an idiot.
it has you sort of like questioning your allegiances and jumping back and forth and stuff between characters. Maurizio Lombardi is the name of the actor who plays Inspector Ravini, the detective. He just the way that he like speaks English is just a really I've never really seen an actor speak English in that way before, and so it's very distinct and very entertaining to me to watch the way that he like sounds out different words and just pronounces things and like he's a very serious character, but he's also like, I think that the show wants to use him a little bit as like some comedic relief in times where, you know, it gets pretty dark, the show. So let's see what other things that I want to touch on with you. At the very end of the show, John Malkovich shows up in this cameo. I think it's in the very last episode. It's just, he shows up for, I don't know, 10 minutes or something. And he's like this kindred spirit to Tom Ripley. He's like, seems to be some sort of fellow con man who gets him like a new identity. And that's kind of like basically how the show ends, or very close to how it ends. And I was like, huh, that's weird. That was John Malkovich just showing up for a minute. That was an odd little bit there. And then I saw somebody on Letterboxd watch a movie called Ripley's Game, which came out in 2003. And I'm like, I've literally never heard of this. I don't have any memory. Like typically, even if I didn't see a movie, you know, I have some sort of awareness of it, especially from that period where I was like in high school going to the movies all the time. And I just like have no awareness whatsoever of this movie called Ripley's Game, which is another adaptation of a Highsmith book or Highsmith story in some way, where John Malkovich plays an older version of Tom Ripley. So I guess that casting was just a sort of callback or like a nod to that. Have you ever seen Ripley's Game?
I actually have seen, I don't remember it, but I have seen it. And also I was looking on the IMDb trivia page of The Talented Mr. Ripley, and it says on there that John Malkovich came really close to directing an adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley before, like he before there was actually a version in the 1960s called Purple Noon is the Prince movie, Purple Noon. And John Malkovich was supposed to direct the American remake of that, and he never got around to doing it. He never got the, so for some reason, for one reason or another, he's always been like circling this property, and I feel like, I guess like he heard they were making a new Talented Mr. Ripley, and he was like, God damn it, I have to be in this. I must be part of the Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah, he's just like a big fan. He just like forces his way in. That's awesome. Okay, so let's talk about the very end of the show. I along the way, I thought the focus on the ashtray, that glass ashtray, was going to be the thing that maybe like brought Tom down in this version, because he uses this ashtray as a weapon, and then he goes to a completely different city and buys a very, very similar ashtray. And that detective comes and like interviews him, and he's like wearing a little bit of a disguise, but not really a great one. And he kind of has his...
Can we talk about that? That really bothered me.
All right, me
like,
too.
As much as I like the show, I'm like, well, come on. Like, all he does is he puts on like a wig and a beard, and this detective, is this detective like that bad at his job that he does it? Because like every other scene makes it seem like the detective is really competent and really good at his job. And then for whatever reason, he can't spot that this is the same guy. Like, I know where there's supposed to be like a certain level of suspension of disbelief or whatever, but that really bugged me. Like, he doesn't like put on like a fake nose or something. Like, he looks exactly, he doesn't even like change his voice. He's like doing the same exact Andrew Scott. Andrew's doing the same exact normal voice that he uses as Tom Ripley. And it's like, come on, this is.
Yeah, I had real trouble with that. I mean, there's this whole thing about this whole through line about Caravaggio and like light and darkness and the Italian painter and like his backstory. And like they actually cut back at one point in the beginning of one of the episodes. They flash back in time to Caravaggio and then like cross cut a little bit with Ripley to kind of like show, at least in Ripley's mind, that there's similarities between those two characters and the arcs that they go on. So I liked all of that stuff. And like the motif, you know, that runs throughout where they like are constantly looking at Caravaggio paintings and all of that. But he uses that in this moment that we're talking about as inspiration for how to get one over on this detective by like closing the blinds in the room and like trying to create this half dark, half lightness on his face to sort of hide his identity or whatever. And I was just like, this just doesn't make any sense. Like this man would absolutely recognize like these beady little weasel eyes of pure evil that are staring directly into his soul that he encountered previously in a different city. He would absolutely recognize this guy. No question.
So. And it's like, it's super convenient that the detective like doesn't try to like shake his hand or anything. Like, he never gets close enough to like, they're sitting at like a distance, and it's just like, man, I try not to get hung up on these sort of things. Like, I'm all for suspension of disbelief, especially like in entertainment and so, but it's like, man, really bothered me.
It simply must be commented on. Like, you know, I'm right there with you. I try not to, but like, this is so egregious that like we had to talk about it. So anyway, I thought the ashtray thing might come back into play, but it never really does. So I thought it was a nice little misdirect. But then the very, very end of the show is finally Marge writing her book, and then there being a picture of the real Dickie Greenleaf in there, and Ravini finally realizing, oh my God, you know, this guy is not who he told me he was, kind of thing.
Usual suspect sort of moment.
Yeah, exactly. I was wondering if you found that to be as satisfying as I did. And in particular, in a previous episode, one of the police characters spells Ripley's last name using the Italian alphabet. Yeah. And as they do that it's kind of very similar to Usual Suspects, like that audio plays back, that little clip plays back over this moment where Ravini realizes Ripley's true identity, and like the actual letters of the alphabet pop up on screen as this character is saying them, and it's like the title of the show is being underlined, and it's like it's the equivalent of like the end, but just repeating the title of the show. And I just thought it was a really cool thing, and I haven't really seen done very often. So I thought it was super satisfying. I was curious what you've made of like the actual very end of the show.
Yeah, I really like that too. It's definitely a satisfying moment. I'm curious to see like if this is going to be like, I don't know if Steven Zalian told you this or not when you interviewed him, but like, are there plans for like to adapt the other books into like future seasons, or is this like a one and done sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't have time to go into that. I'm very curious about that as well, because I feel like it could go either way with this ending.
Because, like, as far as I understand, that's not how the book ends, because Tom Ripley keeps on living and keeps on committing crimes. So I'm curious to see, like, if they wanted to do more or not. Like, I'm guessing that it's going to be, like, so much stuff today is, like, one and done. But I kind of hope it's not, because I dug this enough that I would like to see, like, the other books adapted into, like, future seasons and see this character do more crimes. See Andrew Scott do some more crimes.
Yeah, me too, for sure. Okay, let's take a break and then we'll be right back.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, so before we wrap things up today, here is my conversation with writer, director, producer Steven Zaillian. So there's a deeply methodical quality to both Ripley and your previous TV series, The Night Of, that I really like. It's like when Tom Ripley kills somebody in the show, you don't just jump cut and say, yeah, he's disposing of a body, you get it. You really show us every step in that process. Yeah. So I'm wondering if you can tell me about why that approach is attractive to you as a storyteller.
It started with the novel. Patricia Highsmith would describe it in some detail, getting rid of a body, you know, and I was just kind of became fascinated with this idea that, you know, it's easier to kill somebody than it is to get rid of the body. And, you know, you're on a fourth floor apartment, or even as something as simple as being in a boat with somebody, you think it's going to be easy, but it's not. And to show that, Tom is not a professional killer. You know, I mean, he does the killing out of passion, and then whatever else he does is out of necessity not to get caught. But I thought this is a great opportunity for, like, visual storytelling. There's no dialogue. How exactly would you do this? And I just like shooting all the details of that and showing he doesn't know what to do next, you know, so he... We're seeing him think about it. We might be imagining what we would do, and then we see it play out.
So speaking of the visuals, you shot this series in black and white. Was that a thematic choice? How did that come about?
Basically, it was thematic to the extent that I imagined when I read this novel in the first place that it was a film noir story. And that it lent itself to black and white, and that's how I imagined it when I read it. And then to do it allowed us to show Italy in a way, and New York, in a way that wasn't, you know, kind of a sweet little colorful postcard. You know, it was kind of a foreboding place for a foreboding story.
Did you have any film noir influences in terms of the visuals, any movies that you looked at to try to, you know, emulate?
I didn't really look, like, in preparation for it. Of course, I've seen a lot of them, you know, but no, I think they were just in my mind as a genre, as opposed to anything in particular.
Mm-hmm. You've had the opportunity to work with some of the best directors in the world, but in general, Hollywood doesn't always treat writers particularly well in terms of like being able to visit sets and things like that. So I was wondering if you were able to absorb any specific directing tips or tricks from the time that you may have spent working with all of those top tier filmmakers over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really lucky in that regard. Yeah, to the extent that the directors that I've worked with, for the most part, I'd say like 90% of them, they like writers and they like having writers around. So I've never been, you know, not invited to a set. And this started with the first film that I did, which was called The Falcon and the Snowman. John Schlesinger was one of those directors who loved writers and loved, so I was there every day he was shooting. So I'm sure I absorbed stuff from him. And, but a lot of times I don't go to the set. I mean, it's sort of like I've done my job as a writer. I, you know, these are great directors. I'm there if they need me, but if they don't, you know, it's up to them at that point.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Scott has talked in interviews about how this was a pretty heavy part for him to play and how he felt like it was mentally and physically difficult for him. And I was wondering, since you had so many different roles to play on this show as the writer, producer, director of every episode, how did you navigate working with Andrew to give him what he needed as a performer while still managing to accomplish everything that you needed to from a production standpoint?
You know, it's tough, but I mean, I feel very lucky, you know, to have been given the opportunity to do this, you know, so I'm appreciative of that. Is it hard? Yeah, it's hard, but it's our job. And I looked forward to every day, and solving problems and how are we going to shoot this and planning on the weekends for the next week. You know, all of it was all consuming, but I like that. I mean, I like to be involved in something that's all consuming.
This was quite the process for you. I mean, I think this got officially announced in like 2019 or something like that, right? Yeah. So like what was the, I assume the pandemic was a huge part of the delay, but sort of walk me through what your experience was like over this past, over these past 5 years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it does take a long time when you do it like this, meaning I wrote it all. So that's about an 18-month process there. And then, you know, shopping it around, getting somebody to do it, that takes a couple months. And then once we started doing location scouting at the end of 2019, and when we got back, it was like, okay, now it's the pandemic. So that was another year that everything stopped. And then finally we started shooting, I don't know, in 2021, 2022. I've lost track. But in any case, and it was a long shoot. And if somebody is directing the whole thing, it's different too, because normally they can stagger, you know, shows. They can sort of leapfrog shows, like something's being edited while something else is being shot. For this, I treated it as a long movie. So I finish shooting and then I start editing. You know, it's not, the editing's not going to go on, you know, ahead of time.
Yeah.
So it just takes time.
Yeah, for sure. When you sat down to write this, was there a part of you that was shaping the script knowing that you were going to direct it and sort of realizing what may or may not be possible for you to achieve on set? Or are you able to sort of separate that and, you know, put your true writer hat on and just write as you would? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there was ever a time that I wrote differently if I wasn't going to direct, but for sure I don't do that anymore. And it's not because I know I'm going to direct it. I would write the same script if somebody else was going to direct it. And it's less about putting on the writing hat and more about I can't help but put on the director's hat when I'm writing, even if I'm not going to direct it, because I can't write it unless I can see it in my mind. So I'm kind of shooting it as I go along anyway. And then, of course, it changes. When you really shoot it, everything changes. You know, it's sort of like, oh, you know, this location isn't like what I imagined. And, you know, so you have to reinvent it again and then reinvent it again in the editing. But in terms of the writing, no, it's the same.
I was going to ask you about those changes. Like, what kind of things changed along the way from you? How close was the final version to what you originally conceived?
I mean, a lot of it is as I conceived it. I mean, meaning the scenes, there aren't a lot of scenes that we cut, and there aren't a lot, and there's nothing that I feel like, oh, I should have written another scene here and done something else. It's pretty much the script. And I have to do that because when I am directing, I can't put on a writer's hat. I don't have time. So, and also, I feel like my judgment isn't that good in the 11th hour, you know? So I finish the script. I say, okay, this is it. This is what we're going to shoot. And then, of course, things change. As you know, you discover something on the set, and a scene will change, or somebody will say something, and you'll go with that. And, you know, Maurizio was here doing some interviews, and, you know, that's a character. He plays Inspector Ravini. You know, that's a character that's quite a departure from any of the other versions of this story, where he becomes a main character. And so that was something that, it was in the script, but when we shot it, it was delicious. I mean, I loved all those scenes with him.
Yeah, he was fantastic. Yeah. I think I probably have time for one more question with you. And I was just wondering if you could tell me about filming the Caravaggio flashback. That was another unexpected surprise for
me. No, I love that. Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was, it's actually shot in the same location that Ravini goes to when he's doing his investigation, and he goes to a nightclub. It's actually the same alleyway intentionally. You know, like these two stories are happening in the same places. They're just 350 years apart. And it was great. It was just a fun thing to do, to like suddenly go back 350 years. And I don't know, did we miss something? Are we watching the right show? But then to realize, oh yeah, this whole Caravaggio story has been planted in the whole series. And now we're seeing what happened.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, I love the show, and thank you so much for the time today. I really appreciate it. Congratulations.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Take care. All right. Any other takeaways that we wanted to talk about here, Chris, before we finally wrap up today's episode? Anything else, any observations or any other things from this Ripley series that you wanted to mention?
I'm just curious to see how this goes over, because a lot of stuff today, I forget the term. I think it's like a lot of streaming shows these days are being shot with like second screen in mind, in that you're supposed to be able to watch them without really watching. But basically showrunners are admitting that streaming services are giving them mandates to make it so that viewers can sort of casually watch stuff while they're looking at their phone, which is just really depressing. And I'm very curious to see how this show goes over, if it goes over at all, because this show seems like it's designed not like that at all. Like, you very much have to pay attention to what's going on here, not just like from a story perspective, but just like the cinematography and the way it's shot. And I'm very curious to see if like people like half watch this on their phones and then they're like, I don't know what is going on, because I've been half watching this while scrolling through TikTok or whatever. So yeah, I'm very curious to see how this goes over. They're not really, I don't know if they're like marketing this as well as they should be, because it feels like very classy and very unique for Netflix. And it comes out this week, and I feel like there's very little fanfare, but I guess that's just sort of the way Netflix plays things. Unless it's like Stranger Things or something like that, they don't really go all out. So I do hope people find this and give it a shot. I do think Andrew Scott has sort of become popular thanks to like Fleabag and what was that movie?
All of Us Strangers.
All of Us Strangers. So I do think people will find it because of him. I know my mom loves her some Andrew Scott. She thinks he's super handsome. So I think people will find it. I just hope they give it a chance, because it is a really cool show.
All right. Well, next time you're on the show, Chris, I would love to get your mom's review of Ripley if she watched it. Just tell me what she thinks about it. So that'd be great. Cool. All right. Well, you can find Chris's review of Ripley up at slashfilm.com. I'm going to link to that in the show notes. We may or may not have a couple more stories about the show up there on the website. So I encourage people to go to slashfilm.com and find out for yourself. There's a little tease there. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.